Chapitre 1. Je m'appelle César Adam et je suis à la Nouvelle-Orléans, en Louisiane, aux États-Unis, dans le golfe du Mexique. Chapitre 2.
Part 1. My name is John Houck, and I'm in Los Angeles, California.
Hi, my name is Sarah Witt, and I am in Boston, Massachusetts, or more specifically, Somerville, Massachusetts, S-O-M-E-R-V-I-L-L-E. And what I think is interesting about Somerville, even though nobody wants to know, is that supposedly it has the highest population percentage-wise of artists in the world. Any township or suburb or anything. It's not a suburb, it's a city, but I find that hard to believe thinking about Brooklyn. But it's probably true because there's not that many people that live in Somerville. Anyway, it's near Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is on the other side of the Charles River from Boston.
Je suis assis dans un siège trouvé qui est trop bas et donc j'ai un coussin pour me surélever. Je suis sur une très grande table. Devant moi, j'ai un ordinateur sur lequel j'enregistre ma voix. À ma gauche, j'ai un écran supplémentaire. À ma droite, j'ai un grand panneau d'isolation rose sur lequel j'ai dépunaisé beaucoup de papier sur des choses que j'ai à faire, les projets qui sont en cours, des factures, des choses à payer. Un papier par projet. Ma table est recouverte de notes, de câbles, de crayons, de tasses de café sales, de pièces, de bouquins, de gourdes, de clés, de chocolat, d'appareils photo, d'écouteurs. Je suis dans un grand appartement, dans un grand salon. Il y a deux grandes chambres, un beau jardin avec un grand arbre. C'est le soir. Nous sommes en novembre. Il fait frais. Chapitre 3.
Part 2. Where I'm sitting at, it's in the living room of my apartment. I live between Los Angeles and Brooklyn currently. Well, I shouldn't say between. I actually live in one or the other now and then. My partner lives in LA and I live in Brooklyn. So this is, I'm visiting for an extended Thanksgiving holiday, which is really enjoyable. I just got here yesterday. But what the apartment looks like, it's the sun has just went down and it's sort of dimly lit. The ceiling is all wood paneling, and it absorbs most of the light. Behind me, I've set up a photo studio of sorts. I'm shooting a book project, and there's a lot of paper and seamless paper and different colored paper that I'm shooting different objects on top of. Other than that, the house is very, very orderly and clean. There's five bookshelves filled with books, and all the blinds are currently shut, all the mini vertical blinds. And there are yoga props all over the house. That's the main sort of form of furniture are yoga props. And I'm currently sitting on one and enjoying some tea.
I just heard a beautiful description of someone's place, which I don't want to say I'm jealous because I actually love where I'm sitting right now, which is also in my apartment. And it's funny because the blinds are always open in mine and I have I'm sitting in a tiny studio apartment. Actually, it's a large studio apartment. It's like double the size of a normal studio. And I'm in my kitchen where I do my work. And it's a big open kitchen with a 4-foot wall that separates the wall between where I'm sitting and the living room slash my bedroom. I have a little bedroom nook with a, I'm in the third floor of a house, and there's a skylight that pours light onto my bed to wake me up in the morning, and there are some plants that dangle over my forehead. I'm looking at right now one of the open blinds, which this morning was totally closed. My partner spent the night last night, and this morning he had this brilliant idea to turn my house into a camera obscura, and we covered every single window, which is three, in my apartment with cardboard and tape and blankets, and made it very dark. And it was the strangest thing to have my apartment completely dark at 8 in the morning on a Sunday. And then we ripped all the cardboard off, and now it's bright again. I have a very bright apartment. But I'm looking at my messy table that I built that creaks a lot, and it's not screwed down properly, but doesn't bother me. And I see the word perfection and a couple of open notebooks with lots of vocabulary words that I'm working with for my thesis. I see some neon yellow thread and a pan of chocolate tart ganache concoction I made. And I see some pots and pans hanging and a map of Berlin and a couple of empty glass milk bottles on the counter, some spices, a clock that doesn't work, a really big clock from a factory in New York, actually, and it doesn't work, and there's a sign they put on it that says it doesn't matter, you're probably late already. A red rug, dishes drying in the dish rack, but I did them by hand. They're drying in my dishwasher rack, which I've never actually used my dishwasher because it looks like it was really cheap and crappy, but I love my little cozy apartment. It has wood floors and low ceilings that slant up to an almost peak at the ceiling. If you're 8 feet tall, you can't stand in my apartment. And it's cozy and warm, and it's freezing outside, and there are lots of plants, and they're alive, which is the first time in my life I've been able to keep plants alive for more than about a week. So I'm feeling pretty good looking at the word tactics, looking at the word disruption, rupture, efficiency, accuracy, order, chaos, and the phrase humans are disappearing. I really think humans are disappearing. That's what my thesis is about, is preserving our species. But I've been talking way too much. I need to rest for a second.
La dernière chose que j'ai écrite à la main, c'est mon calendrier. Alors je vais, oui, en fait, j'ai pas voulu acheter un calendrier. J'ai préféré le dessiner moi-même pour que chaque jour soit à la taille, à l'emplacement que je désire sur cette grande feuille que j'ai punaisée au mur. Donc j'ai un grand morceau de papier, enfin en fait de plastique que j'écris au feutre, les dates. Et donc, comme ça, je peux planifier les événements qui sont à venir. Donc je vais vous lire mon calendrier. Novembre, lundi, mardi, mercredi, jeudi, vendredi, samedi, dimanche. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. Décembre. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31. Janvier. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31. Février. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28. J'ai 12 mois qui sont écrits sur mon tableau, mais je pense que c'est pas nécessaire que je vous les lise tous. Chaque jour a des dates et des événements qui sont associés. Mais je souhaite pas les partager avec vous. Chapitre 4.
Part 3. The last time I laughed until I cried. Probably this was the other, like 3 days ago. Leah, my partner, sent me this website called Damn You Autocorrect, and sort of ignored the text or the iChat. I didn't know. The name sounded really lame, and these forwards tend to be a bit distracting. But anyway, later that night, she sent me a few more and some examples of them, and I was definitely kind of cracking up. And then on the phone, I went on my computer, and she went on hers, and we started looking at the site together, and it was just absolutely, there's some insanely hilarious ones that really, that I just couldn't stop laughing at. And the more I looked at the site, the more entrenched I became, and the funnier they became until I was actually crying. I mean, they're really incredible, some of them. And they sort of bring about this kind of like, this strange unconscious that the phone has programmed into it, these like Freudian slips that it makes are just remarkable. The websites, of course, it's a little lame in that you see videos of people watching it and laughing hysterically as well until they cry. It's the entire website is built on this notion, and it even perpetuates the spectatorship of these things by showing you a sort of staged authenticity of people looking at the site and laughing their ass off. But I have to say it did work for me, and I ended up on the phone laughing and crying just looking at these autocorrect different autocorrect entries.
I kind of want to tell the last time I laughed so hard that I cried, which was actually this morning. But I'm not going to, because I am supposed to talk about the best thing I'll ever said to me. And, you know, I just started seeing somebody just about a week ago. And it had been a really long time since I'd been with somebody that cared about me, I think. And I've had 5 partners now, total, that's it. But they've all been kind of long-term boyfriend types. And I actually can't recall anything that would be the best, but maybe it was the first time that somebody told me they loved me that wasn't a family member. And his name was Albert. And I didn't want to be in love with him because he was such a dork. He was like such a nerd. And he wore these stupid shoes, and he liked things like that I just thought weren't cool because I was a freshman in college. But I remember I couldn't stand it anymore. We had spent so much time together, and I was crying because I was like, I don't want to be in love with someone. I know I'm scared. And it was April 9th, and it was 2001. And I called him up, and I said, I need to see you right now. And he said, oh, I need to see you right now. And we ran, and we met. It was kind of random. We, met on the quad of our campus, and we lived on other sides. And it was dark out, and we met on this bench. And all he said to me, we just laid there together on this bench. And he was probably, petting my hair or something that I like. But I know that he said this to me, which was so great at the time. I mean, it's really not that spectacular in retrospect, but in as a first lover, it was special. He said, "I think I'm in love with you," and he really said it like that. And I know that I'm not being very dramatic here, but "I think I'm in love with you. I think I'm in love with you." But maybe that's what I said. Now that I think about it, I think I said the same thing too. I think I said, "I think I'm in love with you too," and then we kissed. But I really can't say it like he did because he had this cute little voice. And but more recently, "I want to give you lots of orgasms." Yeah.
L'homme regarde la fleur. La fleur sourit. Chapitre 5.
Part 4. The smallest thing you can think of that is your favorite of all small things. Talk about everything that comes to mind. I guess the first thing that comes to mind when I think about small things is the way my grandmother would collect small trinkets and always put them in the windowsill in the kitchen. And as children, I come from a pretty large family. I have, like, I don't know, 12 or 13 cousins on my mom's side alone. We would always be there during Christmas, and it was really fun to always pull these objects off the windowsill and from the various places she had kind of squirreled them away in the kitchen on different shelves, kind of high up away, in a way that we couldn't reach them always, but the objects were, you know, like thimbles and different erasers shaped like dogs and things like this, and Wizard of Oz figurines and characters, and she even had small plants as well that sort of were the same scale, like tiny cactuses and things like this all on the shelf. And growing up, these were the kind of, I guess the smallest unit I could comprehend, the sort of atoms of my universe then. And my mom, as she's gotten older, has started to collect small little trinkets as well and keeps them around the house, also on high shelves and sort of remote places in the house, in the kitchen as well. And she has little glass cats and dogs and things like this. And she'll often give me these objects. And one in particular that I love more than any other object, and I'm not exactly sure why, is a small green cloisonné, I don't know if I'm saying that right, fish, one of these little jointed fish. It's about half an inch long, and it's like a green enamel on it, and it's my favorite object. I don't know, it must go back to some early childhood memory of a similar kind of fish or something. It might also have to do with the fact that I'm a Pisces. I have some identification with this animal, but that's my most treasured trinket and small thing that I keep close at hand. I've looked for other similar fish to get other ones, but I've even bought some other cloisonné fish, but none of them are even. They just can't match this one. It's really old and has a certain patina, and it's from definitely from a different time somehow. And I can't seem to find anything that mimics it or looks quite like it.
I'm supposed to talk about the fourth part. I haven't been saying which part I'm doing beforehand. I'm bad. The fourth part, my thoughts on the leaves of plants, the way whiskey barely coats the glass, words in a line on a flat white square, and when my tongue feels fuzzy. I'm thinking about tactility. Each of these is such a different sentiment that I identify with or I don't, you know? I think a lot about words on flat pieces of paper that are white, and I think about the color white and how much I hate it and resent it, but it's everywhere. I use it all the time in my work. I'm obsessed with it because I hate it. I resist it. I resist it. I'm obsessively compulsively clean, actually. And I think it has to do with my environment being this sterile, industrial, capitalist building of factory of intellectuals at MIT. And I resent it. And it's white. The whole building is white. And I just want to mark it up. I want to make it dirty. And I want to yell in it. And I want to create a fire in it. A fire that's passion that I don't see. I think white to me is void of passion. But it's a blank palette where anything you put on it can be clearly discerned from its background. It gives a clean platform for thinking, but I think I would talk about white this whole time. My tongue doesn't feel fuzzy. Last time it felt fuzzy, I think I was eating something and I felt like I had an allergic reaction, but I was actually having anxiety. I had a series of panic attacks this fall. I haven't been the same since. I'll admit that. I haven't been the same since. But I try to prevent my tongue from feeling fuzzy and my body from vibrating and turning into a maniacal vessel for irrational thoughts. And I guess whiskey would be the medicine for that, maybe, to calm. Leaves, you know, leaves, they remind me of brains, and they're special, they're translucent, and like I said, I'm keeping plants alive right now, which is really something I'm treasuring, is having these living creatures in my apartment. I had a cat for a week. It was kind of a disaster. Kitso really drove me nuts, and she was eating the leaves, and I realized that it's okay, I eat leaves too. You know, I eat kale. Sometimes I eat spinach, but I prefer the really leafy greens like kale. But I love that they have little veins that squirt the green chlorophyll all over and keep them alive. And when they start to shrivel and shrink, it's kind of, I feel like I've failed my job as a housekeeper, as a caretaker. But yeah, white. There's something frightening about it, but also very comforting. And words on a page. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Expliquez pourquoi les passagers d'un avion, ou ceux qui sont dans les parkings, ou ceux qui font la queue pour acheter le ticket, ont toujours l'air tristes. Ils attendent. C'est le manque. Ils veulent quelque chose. Un temps pesant. Un temps épais. Un temps absent. Inquiet. Un temps dans lequel les gens se cachent. Un temps où les gens se montre, un temps isolé, un temps de transition, un temps parfait, Chapitre 5. Chapitre 5. Pourquoi les...
Part 5. My earliest memory of feeling free The earliest memory I have of feeling free was somehow not surprisingly, this seems like a bit cliche, like it's been played out in many movies, but was riding my bike, but actually not just riding it. It was at one point when my brother and I learned how to surf on our bikes. So we would ride down the street in front of our house. It was a slight downhill. We'd ride up to the top and get going at a pretty good clip coming down it. And once we were coasting fast enough, we would kind of put our feet up onto the top tube of the bike and then slowly and very carefully work our way up so that we could stand on the seat with both feet and then have our hands on the handlebar still, of course, and surf down the road like this so that our feet were completely off the pedals and we were just sort of, completely free at that moment and free of the constraints of having to pedal and kind of suspended there up in the air, like some sort of like a circus act or something. And my parents didn't take a lot of pictures of us growing up, but there's definitely a really good one of that event, because I know my mom in particular was mortified to see us surfing down the street, of course with no helmets, and showing off, and really this was one of the formative moments for me where I really felt like I was doing my own thing and very, very proud of something that I had learned. I don't even remember exactly where I saw that technique, but that was something my brother and I were really into for a while.
It's really nice to hear the stories. I wish I spoke French. This person has a very compelling voice, but this is part five, excuse me. I'm supposed to talk about the inside space of my head. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about the way that I navigate the world and the way that I function and how I'm the most effective in fulfilling tasks and doing things. And I've realized I'm really inefficient and really disorganized. It's cords, tangles of cords, and I am attempting to move through every knot and loophole. Not undo them, but move through them. Not move through with the wires. Not move through like a synapse or an electrical spark or connection or a circuit. It's not like I'm a circuit. It's like I'm slipping on the outside of the rubber cord, trying to fit into the little holes. I think maybe a more productive and appropriate way of navigating the world would be to actually go inside of those wires and ride the electrical current on a little thin twig of copper. But I've realized in the past month or two that I have a really hard time seeing things and absorbing things and processing things and rendering my thoughts the way that is most easily understood by others. I've had a hard time articulating myself lately, a hard time externalizing how I feel. I have felt this cord, this mess. I feel mess, utter mess, chaos, and I'm trying to embrace it and understand that there isn't one or five or ten different iterations of the way that the mind works and that some of us are jumbled cords. And rather than kind of ignore that and try to overcome that and alter the way I think or the way I do things, I should just ride it. I should be okay with that. I should accept it, because then the margin of disappointment with myself or irritation or frustration will be less. I'll be happier if I understand who I am. I feel very disjointed, very fragmented, and I don't know. Maybe it's just because of where I am and my environment, but I really think that my brain is like a A computer with all the cords severed and packed into a tiny little case, but they're still falling out. It's not pretty, but it's kind of fun. Sparks, maybe. Sparks flying here and there and creating short circuits.
Chapitre 5. Pourquoi les gens qui sont dans l'avion ou dans un parking ou dans... Martin, si tu veux, tu peux faire du bruit. Hein. Tu peux marcher. C'est juste qu'il ne faut pas parler. Sorry, so I'm going to start off again. Chapter 5. So, chapitre 5. Chapitre 5. Ne pensez pourquoi les passagers d'un avion, d'un parking, d'un garage ou ceux qui font la queue pour les tickets ont toujours l'air tristes. Articulez vos pensées. Les passagers, les patients, ils attendent. C'est le manque. Ils veulent quelque chose. Un temps pesant, épais. Un temps absent, inquiet. Un temps dans lequel les gens se cachent. Un temps où les gens se montrent. Isolé, un temps isolé. Un temps isolé. Un temps de transition. Un temps parfait, sans but. Un temps vain, sans but. Un temps qui consume l'homme moderne. L'homme moderne refuse d'attendre. Un temps de promiscuité. Avec un masque triste. Un sourire, c'est une invitation. Un masque triste, ça protège, ça crée une distance. Un sourire, c'est une invitation. Être ensemble, seul. Être seul, ensemble. Avoir peur et conquérir cette solitude. Chapitre 6.
Part 6. The saddest encounter with my parents would have to be, I suppose, when I finally decided to leave Colorado. I grew up there and went to undergrad there. I traveled a bit, but not really growing up. We didn't go out a lot. I didn't fly on an airplane until I was 19 years old, actually. And every vacation we took was always a road trip in the car. And I finally, after undergrad and living in Colorado a few years, I decided to go to graduate school and to move to Los Angeles for this. And I guess the morning I left Colorado to move to LA, I left very early. I was driving. I had all my belongings in my car, and I remember very vividly going up, and my parents were still both in bed and asleep, and going in there and telling them that, you know, telling them goodbye, and knowing that I probably wasn't going to move back to Colorado, and thinking, or at least my perception of them and what they thought, was that they thought this was just a temporary thing, that I would move back maybe even after a year or something, and that made me quite sad. It made it much harder to leave, because I thought, perhaps wrongly, but that they expected I would come right back to Colorado, and that this was just a flash in the pan or something. But now I live in New York, and I don't really have any plans to move back to that area, and it's still a kind of a sad, difficult thing for me that they still think, or desire me to move back there very, very strongly. And this is where I think when I left that morning is when I really sensed this the most.
I think it's pretty obvious that I'm in love, maybe. This is part six. And I am going to tell a joke, but it's not even a joke. It's just I thought it was really funny. Oh, there's two of them. Well, I'll tell the first. It's short. I'm seeing somebody who was sick last week. And I have a really strong immune system, and I don't get sick very often. And probably because I eat a lot of sauerkraut or something, but he was kind of sick, and we were in bed, and I said something about, I said, "Oh, you're so warm." And he just said really deadpan, "That's because I have a fever."
Votre plus grand moment de bravoure, décrivez. Pendant l'hiver de 2003 à 2004, j'étais étudiant à Central Saint Martins à Londres et j'ai eu l'opportunité de faire une installation, une sorte de sculpture collaborative qui s'appelait, enfin que j'ai appelé Human Experience. Et l'idée c'était d'interroger qu'est-ce que c'est la culture humaine. En fait, c'était un sujet qui a été posé dans la classe à cause de notre multiculturalisme. C'est-à-dire qu'il y avait beaucoup d'étudiants de partout dans le monde. Et le professeur a demandé, bon, voilà, vous allez représenter en gros votre culture. C'était un peu comme un tour du monde, c'était ça l'idée. Mais comme je suis ni français, ni vraiment japonais, ni anglais, je ne savais pas trop quelle culture je devais m'atteler à décrire. Et dans ce contexte, je me suis dit, dans ce cas-là, peut-être le mieux pour moi, c'est de chercher, au contraire, d'écrire une culture qui est commune, au lieu d'écrire une commune qui nous différencie. Et donc j'ai commencé à interviewer les gens, et puis petit à petit, j'ai demandé aux gens qu'est-ce qui constitue leur culture, et pour simplifier, ce qui constitue la culture des gens, c'est les émotions. Et même, on peut descendre à un niveau plus primaire, une sorte de culture humaine, ce serait une culture qui serait constituée des sensations. Des sens, le toucher, la vision, le goût, etc. Le sens de l'équilibre, tout c'est une expérience du corps. L'expérience du corps humain. Et donc, j'ai monté cette grande structure en bois qui est recouverte de papier blanc en forme d'estomac, une sorte d'estomac géant de 15 mètres de long et de 5 mètres de haut dans lequel les gens rentraient et dans lequel je les invitais à peindre sur les murs des sensations fortes dont ils ont fait l'expérience. Mais en fait, quand on demande aux gens de peindre leurs sensations, c'est très difficile. Les gens, en général, restent dans une sorte de carcan émotionnel et sensoriel. Et donc, pour les aider à créer ces dessins, je prenais maximum 5 personnes à la fois dans l'installation. Maximum, en général, c'était 3. Et donc, je leur demandais, et je préparais les gens comme un échauffement de danse, d'art martial ou d'une activité physique intense. Donc je leur demandais d'abord d'arrêter de respirer. Ensuite, je leur demandais donc autant de temps qu'ils peuvent. Ensuite, je leur demandais de tourner en spirale sur eux-mêmes autant de temps qu'ils peuvent. Et ensuite, je leur demandais de se mettre debout sur les deux pieds. Ensuite, d'être debout sur un pied seulement. De fermer un œil, puis l'autre. Et donc rien qu'en faisant cet petit exercice, très vite les participants se retrouvaient dans une situation où donc, ils étaient échauffés. Et donc je leur demandais à ce moment-là s'ils pouvaient prendre les pinceaux et dessiner les sensations. Pourquoi je leur demande de dessiner ça, les sensations, leurs sensations fortes? C'est lorsque j'ai fait des interviews de gens pour préparer cette recherche, quand j'ai commencé à poser aux gens la question de quelles sont les sensations que vous rappelez qui sont les plus fortes pour vous. En général, l'explication de la sensation allait tellement vite que j'étais incapable de prendre des notes et finissais par faire des dessins. Et en fait, les dessins étaient quelque chose comme des sensations qui sont primaires et qui sont primordiales en fait à l'expression humaine. Donc en fait, les dessins étaient la manière plus rapide d'exprimer ces sensations, plus vite que écrire du texte. Et donc, en quelques jours d'exposition et quelques centaines de visiteurs, je me suis retrouvé avec cette immense construction en papier recouverte de dessins. Donc, chaque participant est venu à peindre son propre corps dans des situations insolites en général. Donc, ça allait du faire du saut à l'élastique à être enceinte ou faire de l'hélicoptère ou s'engager dans un combat de rue ou écouter de la musique, être transporté, être perdu dans l'obscurité, nager au fond de l'océan, tomber dans l'escalier, faire l'amour. Toutes ces sensations physiques qui sont très très fortes. Éventuellement, l'exposition est devenue un peu hors de contrôle. Donc c'est devenu une sorte d'immense temple en fait. C'est une sorte d'immense temple assez incroyable, donc qui était recouvert de symboles, de dessins de corps humains. Et la sécurité de l'école en fait a jugé que c'était devenu une œuvre qui était dangereuse au niveau de la sécurité, ça pouvait prendre feu, je ne sais pas quoi. Et donc, ils sont arrivés et ils m'ont demandé de détruire l'installation dans les heures qui venaient. Donc, cette installation que des centaines de gens étaient venus et dans laquelle ils s'étaient confiés. En réalité, tous les dessins, c'était des dessins des expériences des corps, de cette culture humaine qu'on partage. Et subitement, le pouvoir... L'agence de sécurité de l'école me demandait de détruire ce temple qu'on venait de construire ensemble. Et j'avais absolument aucun choix que de détruire ce temple. Et donc, j'avais aucun outillage sur moi, et donc j'ai dû détruire ce temple en quelques minutes, au risque de me faire renvoyer de l'école. Et donc tout seul, j'ai brisé ce temple en petit morceau, j'ai cassé ce travail de centaines de gens avec une très grande violence parce que c'était la seule possibilité pour le temps qui m'était accordé. Et donc, détruit la taille d'une maison et en petits morceaux, quoi, une montagne de déchets. Et donc, une fois que cette montagne de déchets elle était en train de joncher le sol, je me suis effondré sur cette montagne. Et je ne sais pas vraiment si je me suis endormi, mais je crois que j'ai jamais eu un moment de bravoure, de courage, d'un aussi grand courage. Et le courage, c'était pas de détruire le travail des gens, ou leurs rêves, ou leurs sensations, mais c'était d'accepter à ce moment-là que les rêves, autant que la réalité qu'on fabrique en fait tous les jours, et sont d'une fragilité équivalente. C'est-à-dire qu'à ce moment-là, la vie ou la mort, ou le plaisir, la douleur, les rêves ou la réalité, sont des choses que j'étais à ce moment-là incapable de discerner, et j'acceptais cet état de non-discernement. Et je pense que c'est le moment le plus haut, on va dire, où j'étais le plus courageux, parce que j'ai accepté d'abandonner cette soi-disant objectivité. Donc si on me demande qu'est-ce que c'est mon plus grand moment de courage, je pense que c'est ce moment en fait d'abandon. Que j'ai pu partager avec ces gens et détruire également. C'est ce moment de naissance et de construction.
Part 7. Number 1. To have my neck kissed. Number 2, to have my shoulders massaged. Number three, in yoga, when the instructor, when you're doing a twist and the instructor comes around and helps you, kind of puts a knee into your back and grabs the other shoulder and it makes the twist much deeper. That's one of my favorite things. Number four, when somebody holds my hand while I'm driving. Number five, when someone rubs my stomach while I'm watching a movie.
Part seven. I'm going to read a quote by Bolaño. I do not speak Spanish, but I'm assuming Bolaño is Spanish. It's a quote that's written in front of me that is going to prompt me to say something else. But .. time isn't the only source of terror. Pleasure can be terrifying too. And so can courage. Terror. I think things are terrifying because you realize that it's not just you in the world that matters. It's not just your opinion or how you think. It, what other people think, their opinions of you. That defines who you are, and it can be very frightening, anxiety to think that maybe I'm not okay if somebody else doesn't verify that. And so it's I think it has to do with self-esteem, terror. Has to do with security and confidence. And again, is it obvious that I'm in love? Gee whiz. But I was reading with my friend last night the cyborg hypothesis, and I want to read a whole paragraph here, and I'm not very good at reading out loud, and I'm probably misconstruing the meaning of this theory here, but it's talking about ways to counter our accelerated culture, and they talk about speed and slowness as a way of resisting. So I'm going to read a paragraph here, and I think it's really relevant. Above and beyond speed and slowness in communications, there is the space of encounters, which allow one to trace out an absolute limit to the analogy between the social world and the physical world. This is basically because two particles never encounter one another except where their rupture phenomena can be deduced from laboratory observations. It's a little technical, sorry. The encounter is that durable instant where intensities manifest between the forms of life present in each individual. It is, even above the social and communications, the territory that actualizes the potential of bodies and actualizes itself in the differences of intensity that they give off in compromise. Encounters are above language, outside of words. In the virgin land of the unspoken, in suspended animation, a potential of the world which is also its negation, its power to not be. What is other people? Another possible world, responds Deleuze. The other incarnates the possibility that the world has of not being, of being otherwise. This is why the so-called primitive societies, war takes on the primordial importance of annihilating any other possible world. It is pointless, however, to think about conflict without also thinking about enjoyment, to think about war without thinking about love. In each tumultuous birth of love, the fundamental desire to transform oneself by transforming the world is reborn. The hate and suspicion that lovers excite around them is an automatic defensive response to the war they wage, merely by loving each other. Against a world where all passion must misunderstand itself and die off. Terror, terrifying. Other people being close.
Chapitre 7. La plus belle chose que votre amoureux ou amoureuse vous ait dit. Et dites-le de la manière qu'il ou elle vous l'a dit. Je saute. Est-ce que tu sautes avec moi? Chapitre 8.
Part 8. I'm in love with you.
Part 8. Oh my god.
Imaginez que la peau de votre dos est en train d'être défaite, comme celle d'un masque. Imaginez la sensation et décrivez-la. Donc zip, la peau de mon dos qui est sourde comme un masque. Première chose, c'est un masque, c'est quelque chose qu'on porte devant soi. Alors que je retire le masque par l'arrière, c'est comme si j'étais pris par défaut ou que quelqu'un m'attrapait en flagrant délit. La sensation, elle est du froid et puis la peur d'être découvert qui rend le froid encore plus froid. Je crois que je peux pas vraiment ressentir cette sensation. Je pense que je vois pas en fait à quel moment je pourrais être démasqué. Je pense que c'est quelque chose qui est volontaire. Je pense que si le masque est en train de tomber, il serait pas sur la peau du dos, mais sur le visage, à l'avant, non pas à l'arrière. Parce que je ne masque pas pour ne pas être démasqué. Je veux dire, c'est quelque chose qui est contrôlé. Peut-être que je me trompe. Maintenant, si ça devait m'arriver, si j'étais masqué et que j'étais démasqué par l'arrière, je pense que la sensation serait celle d'une délivrance. Quand on est volontairement en train de se démasquer soi-même, c'est un acte en fait où on ouvre au monde encore un autre masque en dessous, alors que si on est pris par défaut, peut-être c'est l'occasion de ne de pas être préparé et d'offrir son dos. Peut-être qu'il y ait notre plus vrai visage. Après, l'intitulé voudrait que ce soit quelqu'un qui vous ouvre le dos. Alors, ce qui est important, c'est de savoir aussi comment cette personne vous découvre. Est-ce que c'est avec véhémence? Est-ce que c'est agressif? Ou est-ce que c'est plutôt un moment érotique? Ou un moment de contraire juste d'innocence, de curiosité? C'est vraiment important, l'attitude, le geste. Ça, on le sent quand on se fait déshabiller. En tout cas, c'est quelque chose qui est nécessairement souhaitable, je pense, d'être déshabillé. Si on accepte l'idée que l'idéal dans la vie, c'est la réalité nue, alors le fait d'être surpris de découvrir sa propre nature, c'est une bonne chose. Donc je dirais que c'est la sensation, sensation de surprise suivie d'une rapide sensation de peur. Mais j'espère qu'il est suivi d'une sensation prolongée de délivrance. Et puis si ça dure, que ce soit pas une sensation d'être exposé, d'être fragile, mais au contraire d'être fort dans cette vraie nature révélée. Et que ce soit un sentiment de sécurité, nu, qui soit durable. Je pense que c'est ça la sensation, enfin, la suite de sensations, l'enchaînement de sensations que je percevrai et que je souhaite également. Fin.